Kingston, Ontario, Canada. Stay heavy.
Down the short set of stairs, join me, Grim, in the basement for my working knowledge of indie, experimental, post-punk, and electronic, every Wednesday from 10 until 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Get ready to press record.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Good evening. It is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by your CFRC News Collective, Ara McCauley, Jesse Bell, and Jenny Hinch. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcasts, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Ara McCauley, and here are your local news headlines. The recent deferral of a final version of the City of Kingston's official plan was predicated by a number of factors, including several reports that are not expected to be completed until fall 2026 or later. One of the large issues of concern for several groups has been the conversation around the urban boundary expansion. Claims of misinformation, lack of concrete details, and environmental concerns have surrounded the discussions. Kingston Climate Justice Coalition has been vocal about their concerns, issuing a media release ahead of Council's most recent meeting and hosting a petition on their website titled No Urban Boundary Expansion Decisions Without Full Fiscal and Environmental Transparency. We spoke to Chris Gusson, co-chair of the group, to discuss the decision.
Ara, thank you for having me on.
What is your organization? How did it form and what do you do here in Kingston?
My name is Chris Gusson. I'm the co-chair of the Kingston Climate Justice Coalition. We're a network of local organizations that are working to make sure that City Council acts on the climate crisis with the urgency that crisis demands and also with compassion for all kinds of different Kingstonians. We formed a couple of years ago, supported by the Providence Center for Peace, Justice, and the Integrity of Creation. And another key founding member was 350 Kingston, as well as Seniors for Climate Action Now Kingston. So those were some of the organizations that were there at the inception. And first big project was to develop Kingston's climate report card. So the motivation there was Kingston says a lot of good things about climate action. We were the first city in Ontario to declare a climate emergency. But we wanted to be able to look in a more granular way at what progress was actually being made and in which areas were the city falling short. So we developed this report card, which gives the city good marks on things like transportation, but then gives the city quite poor marks on aspects of climate justice, like caring for vulnerable peoples. The city has a pretty bad track record displacing homeless people and with being slow on protecting renters from high temperatures, which is an increasingly severe issue, the climate emergency. So that's how we formed. And since then, we've continued to grow our membership. And one of the issues that we identified from the start was the potential for Kingston to expand its urban boundary and to lean more into urban sprawl. And so that's something that we've been campaigning on more recently with the recent push around the official plan.
Speaking of the official plan, so there was a city council meeting on May 19th where the adoption or the finalization of the plan was postponed. What are your feelings on that? Are you happy to see that they're taking more input? Your group released a media release highlighting some concerns about a week before the meeting. Do you think that you're being listened to and then that played into the delay?
Yeah, we've spent the last few months working to make sure that the growth plan for Kingston, the official plan, is built on a foundation of facts and not just assumptions or feelings. So we're really proud that City Council agreed to pause the process and get the decision right last week. We do feel like it's a significant win for transparency and evidence-based planning. And by choosing to wait, Kingston has made sure that this major decision, this 25-year decision, is not going to be made without the financial analysis, the infrastructure plans, the environmental protection policies that are currently missing. So we also think it's a win for local movements for climate action and for a more democratic city. We do think our voices were listened to and did feed into this vote happening. Hundreds of people emailed their councillors, hundreds of people signed our petition and shared our social media posts to get the word out. So we really do think that citizen voices made the difference here.
According to the group, City Council was being asked to vote on large urban growth boundary expansions before key reports were received, something they likened to council being asked to sign a blank check. They argue that proceeding without complete data is a financial and environmental risk to every Kingston resident. Another environmental group, Building Kingston's Future, hired Mark Heaton, senior ecologist with ecology consulting service Symbiosis Ecology Corp., to review Kingston's natural heritage study. Building Kingston's Future argues that the city's reliance on development-driven environmental impact studies, EIS, has done little to prevent ongoing forest loss and fragmentation, and argues for a nature-first approach in the official plan. In his report, Heaton found that Kingston has lost approximately 34 square kilometers of forest cover to development since 2004. This is despite Section 2.82 of the existing official plan, which states that forests and trees are recognized as a critical part of the city's health and character. The existing official plan also stated that Kingston will take steps to achieve the Environment Canada guideline of 30% minimum forest coverage in the urban area and maintain the existing forest coverage outside of the urban boundary, as well as achieve a doubling of the urban forest cover by 2025. Heaton's report recommends working towards at least 40% cover as a medium risk approach consistent with Environment Canada's guidelines for watershed health.
In addition to the media release, you did share quite a comprehensive study that was put together by Mark Heaton. Building Kingston's Future hired him on to do a review of the official plan, and there were a few things that jumped out. One of the things was the city's failure to meet the minimum forest cover goal. There was concern that the city claims to want to reach certain goals, but not only failed to do so, but actually there has been more forest loss since the last official plan. Is that a major concern for you? And what are the other concerns?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for taking the time to read Mark's study. And that is a great example of what we're worried about, is that the official plan and many of the city's documents have lots of nice language and big promises. So you pointed to the example, Kingston promised to double forest cover by 2025. But since 2004, we've actually lost forest cover. That's the equivalent of two-thirds of Frontenac Provincial Park. So a massive amount has been lost within the urban boundary. So we're already well below this red line that's being defined for ecological health. So that's something we're concerned would continue if we were to expand our urban boundary. So there are sensitive woodlands and wetlands that are just outside of Kingston's urban boundary. And if council decides to go ahead with this expansion, then we think that they would suffer the same fate as the forest cover that's been lost within the city limits. So that is certainly a concern.
In his report, Heaton notes that the second draft of the official plan is moving in the right direction, but needs further work to protect, rehabilitate, and restore woodlands and wetlands, and recommends that the effectiveness of 2020-10 policies need to be critically assessed to understand what natural features have been lost and why.
There are recommendations in Mark's study. For example, he wanted to see 40% growth. He also recommended some changes to wordings to make it more strong. Are you hopeful that the time that City Council is taking now will include taking those recommendations into account?
We are hopeful. We think that the decision to move the timeline has bought us valuable time. We were in sort of a reactive mode trying to make sure that this decision wasn't rushed, and now we hope to move into more of a constructive mode. So we have plenty of great ideas, recommendations from independent experts on how the plan can be made stronger so that we can actually protect our natural heritage, so that our wetlands or woodlands and wildlife corridors can stay intact and contribute as critical climate resiliency infrastructure and somewhere for our community and our non-human neighbors to enjoy.
Kingston Climate Justice Coalition and other groups note that they are not against growth, but advocate for urban densification, which they frame as sensitive intensification over outward sprawl.
We're not against growth. We know that there needs to be housing, but We think that this urban boundary expansion would lead to Kingston growing in a way that's extremely inefficient for taxpayers. It would lead to the need to construct a lot of new roads and sewers, and also contributes to traffic and the climate crisis by making the city more car dependent.
At the council meeting, Councillor Stephen openly criticized the idea that the expansion plan constituted urban sprawl. However, Gusin notes that previous plans that referenced complete communities have historically been disregarded by developers due to a lack of firm regulations.
My first issue is around misinformation, and I feel like a lot of whether it's stuff on social media, emails, blogs, what have you, but there's a lot of information characterizing this new official plan as urban sprawl. It is not that. That is not what is happening. You are still seeing subdivisions built out in the West End that I would characterize as urban sprawl. They are car-centric neighborhoods. That's what the design was when they were approved like 15 years ago. So yeah, we're still seeing the remnants of that, but that is not how we want to see the city move forward. We are looking at complete communities. We are looking at choice and transportation and how we get around the city. And when people are characterizing it as urban sprawl and copying and pasting emails to us, I wonder if they've even read the plan. Go straight to the source. You can't rely on Facebook comments and email chains. That's not the real information.
One particular counselor said that we were spreading misinformation by claiming that the official plan promotes sprawl. And they pointed to the use of language around complete communities in the official plan as evidence that it's not sprawl. But by definition, expanding the urban boundary is urban sprawl. And also, there has been nice language about complete communities in previous planning documents, and previous city councils have asked for subdivisions to be designed as complete communities with retail and businesses in addition to housing. But often developers will just push back and say, no, we can't do that, or there's not an appetite for it. So without really strong legislation or guidelines, expanding the urban boundary just opens that Pandora's box and leads to more urban sprawl.
Gusin further expressed disappointment with Councillor Stephen's assertion that the public had not read the plan.
Councillor Stephen was outspoken at that meeting about misconceptions around urban sprawl, and also stated that there was a lot of misinformation being spread or partial information on Facebook and petitions. Do you feel like that's accurate?
We are very careful to make sure that our advocacy is grounded in truth and that we're not spreading misinformation. And I found it very disappointing to hear Councillor Stephen label public participation as misinformation. And I thought that her remarks were very condescending, essentially dismissing advocates and saying that we hadn't read the official plan and we were just asking for more time to read it. So in fact, we were not asking for more time to read the plan. We were asking for council to make a decision informed by a full financial implementation plan, which has not yet been made public, to wait for the wastewater master plan, which is not coming until this fall. So I totally reject the idea that we're spreading misinformation. I think it's actually disrespectful and unhelpful for a sitting city councillor to imply that community advocates are doing something wrong by trying to engage and to understand more about these serious decisions.
Studies prepared by Watson and Associates Economists Limited for the official plan stated that, quote, land needs assessments have shown that the city does not have sufficient land within the existing urban boundary to accommodate the projected population and employment growth. While the city recognizes that urban boundary decisions are significant and acknowledges residents' concerns about where developments are located, they noted that the provincial policy requires all municipalities to present them with a long-term plan that ensures sufficient land has been allocated to accommodate a projected growth to 2051. Commissioner Agnew further outlined the staff's review process and clarified that land brought into the boundary was not necessarily set for development.
Just bringing land simply into the boundary doesn't mean that it's development ready. It means that it has development potential or it's identified over the long term for development, but it still has to go through a process of checks and balances that are administered directly by council with recommendations and technical information that come from staff associated with the timing unlocking those decisions.
Councillor Tozo cited the council's commitment to build up, not out, but argued that the plan still needs to identify space for urban expansion, warning that if the city does not, the province will choose for them.
If council does not provide land for an urban boundary expansion, we risk losing control of how it happens. If we submit an official plan to the province of Ontario with our projected population growth and do not provide enough housing and employment land, the province has the power to choose for us. If we don't choose the future of the urban boundary here at City Hall, Doug Ford will. And I have little faith his government will care much about our local needs or natural heritage.
Councillor Stephen echoed the sentiment, saying urban expansion is what it takes to build a city.
We need to expand the urban boundary. It's not a debate. It's not a discussion of if, it's where. So there are some proposed properties that are out there. Some people, property owners, raised their hands and said, we want to join the urban boundary. And so staff took a really critical look at those properties. Some of them made the cut. Some are being explained as rural expansion areas, and some did not at all. And then there are some other areas that were brought in that people maybe didn't want brought in, but that's what it takes to build a city. You have to make these difficult choices. So here we are. We are going to expand the urban boundary. So I just want to be clear that deferring the decision about adopting the official plan doesn't mean that we're not expanding. We have to do it. If we don't do it, if council puts our head in the sand and says, we don't want to expand the urban boundary because people don't like it, well then guess what? The province is going to do it for us. And I'm pretty sure they don't care about our natural heritage system the way we do.
Councillor Tozzo asked staff to explain the consequences of council not designating their own urban boundary expansion areas as mandated by the provincial government and urged council to keep the decision local.
Much of this process that we're doing is dictated by the province. I just want staff to talk about what happens if council doesn't decide on growing the urban boundary.
So again, it goes back to our population projections, which are then extrapolated, and that data is used to determine what our land needs analysis is overall. And that's for the 25-year plan. So that's taking in consideration what is here in terms of vacant land within the boundary now, what has to come in to be able to meet those long-term projections. So the province is going to look at all those numbers. They've already looked at the numbers because they've reviewed two drafts now. So they've seen the population projections. They know what our land needs are, and they understand that based on our intensification targets that we need urban boundary expansion to meet our housing needs long-term and our employment needs. If we provided the population projections, but then we correspondingly gave them a plan where we didn't provide for the land needs associated with the 25-year plan, they would say, come back to us and say, City of Kingston, what are you doing? And City of Kingston, here are the minister's modifications relative to changing your plan so that the numbers line up with what your plan is showing that you need over the 25 years. So there is a track record of doing that. Certainly not something that the minister's office likes to do, but they will ensure that the municipality has a plan that meets Ontario planning legislation.
Thank you. And I just want to reiterate, I think Councillor Stephen said and I said earlier, it's not a question of if the urban boundary expands, it's who decides. City Council or the provincial government? We've had so much power taken away from us from planning and development. Just a word of advice to the next council, keep the decision local. Thank you.
Now that the decision has been deferred, Kingston Climate Justice Coalition is looking forward to the release of the new timeline.
We're looking and waiting now for the city to release a new timeline and tell us what public engagement milestones are ahead. The motion that was passed deferred the decision till 2027, but it didn't set out in detail what new opportunities there will be to look at a third draft of the official plan, to look at the next draft of the natural heritage study, and to see some of these budget numbers that we haven't seen yet. So I sent an inquiry to the city earlier this week and didn't get a detailed answer. So we're definitely going to be keeping an eye on that and trying to make sure that the citizens who want to engage have an opportunity to do so.
So what are the next steps for you and for the other organizations that you collaborate with? Is the petition still ongoing?
The petition is still ongoing. So if listeners visit climatecoalition.ca, that's our website. That's where you can find the petition. We have essentially won what we were asking for with that petition. So our real next step is going to be to continue to focus attention on this issue and try to build up our volunteer capacity so that we can make this an election issue. This is an election year. In October, Kingstonians will go to the polls and select the next city council and mayor. And so if listeners are activated around this issue, our real focus now is to get more volunteers and to work on unpacking this complex document and this complex decision that is the official plan and the natural heritage study and the associated plans, unpacking that for the public, educating the public about what's in there and what we're asking for, and trying to engage in good faith with the city about making real improvements. So you can follow us on Instagram at climatecoalitionygk. You can also find us on Facebook or check out our website, climatecoalition.ca. And we're going to be having our next monthly meeting on Thursday, June 11th at 7 p.m. So you'll find the Zoom link for that on our website and social media channels. We think this is a really important issue. It's a 25-year decision for Kingston, and we are fighting for a city that keeps building inwards instead of sprawling outwards. We want to build smart, we want to protect nature, and we want to respect taxpayers. So we think it's a clear choice, and we reject the idea that urban sprawl is inevitable.
That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is Jesse Bell with your CFRC Sports Desk.
This is Jesse Bell with your CFRC Power Plays Sports Report, and today we're going to be focusing on two upcoming championship series in the professional ranks, one in the NBA and the other in the NHL. Let's start with the NBA, as Victor Wembanyama and the San Antonio Spurs managed to close out the defending champion Oklahoma City Thunder 111-103 on the road to clinch that Game 7 victory and move on to the NBA Finals. Wembanyama had 22 points, 7 rebounds, 2 assists, and a block, and his great defensive efforts were aided by Julian Champagny, who put up an efficient 20 points, going 6 for 11 from the field, all 6 of his makes from the 3-point line, shooting a scorching 60% from behind the arc. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander had his best game of the series, putting up 35 points on 12 for 21 shooting, but ultimately, it was all for naught, as the San Antonio Spurs, who just 3 years prior were a lottery team, have now made their way back to the NBA Finals for the first time without Greg Popovich as their head coach. The New York Knicks await them in the NBA Finals. The Knicks swept the Cleveland Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference Finals and actually have won 12 consecutive playoff games, one of the best playoff runs in history. They would need to pick up 4 more wins to lift the Larry O'Brien Trophy for the first time in nearly 60 years. Game 1 of the NBA Finals will tip off in San Antonio on Wednesday, June 3rd at 8:30 p.m. The NHL Stanley Cup final matchup is set. It will be the Vegas Golden Knights representing the Western Conference, taking on the Carolina Hurricanes coming out of the East. After a hot and cold regular season, Vegas raised eyebrows when they fired their head coach and replaced him with John Tortorella with just 8 games remaining on the regular season slate. It seemed to light a fire under this team as they have bulldozed their way to the Stanley Cup final. They picked up a 4-2 series victory over Utah in round 1, a 4-2 series victory over Anaheim in round 2, and most impressively, a 4-0 sweep over the NHL's top seed, President's Trophy winning Colorado Avalanche to advance to the Stanley Cup Finals. They will face a Carolina Hurricanes team that looks to be one of the best playoff teams in a generation. They swept the Senators in round 1, they swept the Flyers in round 2, and they had a gentleman's sweep of the Montreal Canadiens in the Eastern Conference Finals. After dropping game 1, they surged back into contention, winning multiple games in overtime before clinching the series with a definitive 6-1 victory. Vegas is led in part by former Toronto Maple Leafs player Mitch Marner, who has had a strong playoff campaign, while Carolina is backstopped by another former Leaf, goaltender Frederik Andersen. This should be a fantastic, physical, and fast-paced series, and puck drops in Game 1 on Tuesday, June 2nd at 8 p.m. in Raleigh, North Carolina. That is a wrap on your sports report. Coming up next, I have your Environment Canada weather report and City of Kingston traffic report for the Kingston region. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We begin with Monday, June 1st, a strong start to the month of June here in the city of Kingston. 20 degrees was your high, dropping down to 10 overnight. Tuesday, June 2nd, another 20 degree day in the forecast, this time with a mix of sun and cloud, dropping down to 10 overnight once more. Wednesday, June 3rd, 23 degrees is your high with a mix of sun and cloud, dropping down to 11 overnight. And then starting on Thursday, Thursday, June 4th, we get a run of warm weather here early in the month. 26 is your high for June 4th with a mix of sun and cloud, feeling closer to 28 out in the sun, so it's going to be toasty. Friday, June 5th, another 26 degree day, but with a 40% chance of precipitation, dropping down to 15 overnight. And starting off the first weekend in June, we have got a 26 degree day on Saturday, June 6th, with a mix of sun and cloud, cooling off ever so slightly Sunday, June 7th, with a 23 degree high and a 40% chance of precipitation. But the start of next week, Monday, June 8th, is going to be gorgeous, 25 and sunny here in the city of Kingston. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. On Bath Road between Sir John A. McDonald Boulevard and Portsmouth Avenue, expect delays as crews continue installing intersection pedestrian signals. Over on King Street West from Country Club Drive to Front Road, expect delays as Utilities Kingston work has reduced traffic to one lane in each direction. Watch for lane shifts, reduced speeds, and shared lane signage. Bear in mind that Cranbrook Street from Days Road to Lakeview Avenue is closed every school day in the morning from 8:40 to 9:20 a.m. and 3:20 p.m. to 3:50 p.m. in the afternoons as part of the School Streets program, restricting access during school drop-off and pickup times. Wright Crescent remains closed between Palace Road and Kingsland Crescent for roadway repairs and safety improvements. Construction continues on Princess Street from Frontenac to Division as part of a major reconstruction project, and long-term closures remain in place on Aberdeen Street between Johnson and William and Berry Street at Queen. Also worth noting that Sydenham Street is closed to through traffic between Princess Street and Queen Street for the Sydenham Street community space. On-street parking on Sydenham Street remains available. And lastly, Public Services and Procurement Canada wishes to advise the public that the LaSalle Causeway will be fully closed to vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians to allow for the temporary opening of the main marine navigation channel on June 7th. Coming up next is Genevieve Hinch with CFRC's concert and events calendar for the week.
Hello, Kingston, and welcome back to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's Community News and Arts Coordinator, Jenny, and this is your weekly events and concerts calendar. Whether you're looking for live music, local markets, trivia nights, theater, workshops, or just something fun to do around the city, there's plenty happening in Kingston this week. Let's get into it. Starting off with Monday, Calvin Park Branch is hosting Stories in the Garden from 10:30 to 11 a.m., while the Central Branch Library has Craft and Create running from 6 to 7:30 p.m. Jazz fans can head over to the RCHA Club for the Jazz Society Jam from 4:30 to 6:30, and later that evening, the Morning Doves perform at Musiki Cafe from 8 to 11 p.m. Trivia also returns to Something in the Water Brewing Company from 8 to 10 p.m. Tuesday brings a mix of community events and live music. The Kingston Youth Climate Council is hosting a toxic trivia party at the Central Branch Library from 5:30 to 7 p.m., while Daff Brewing hosts Euchre Night from 7 to 9. Live music includes Eric Huron and Megan Ballone performing at the Cove Inn. Musiki Cafe's weekly open mic night is Tuesday as well. On Wednesday, Thrives 365 is hosting Bird Life on Campus, a walk to notice nature at Miller Hall from 11 a.m. to noon. Later on, both Something in the Water Brewing Company and the Royal Canadian Legion are hosting board game nights starting at 5 and 6 p.m. Daff Brewing and La Vida Bistro also have trivia and euchre running throughout the evening. If you're looking for live music, Bobby Cameron performs at the Bank Gastro Bar, while Glenn Jones, Liam Grant, and Jack Pine take over Something Else Records from 4 to 6 p.m. The Grad Club also hosts an open stage drag show beginning at 8 p.m. Thursday keeps things busy with the Kingston Public Market running all day in Springer Market Square from 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. The Tet Center is hosting both a needle felted landscape workshop and make a robot butterfly workshop in the evening. If comedy is more your thing, Daff Brewing has a stand-up comedy night from 8 to 11 p.m. Live music includes Clear Breeze at Hotel Wolf Island, Lotus White performing at Monte's as part of the sit-down series, and Sam Coons alongside Lankis Pell at the RCHA Club. Theater lovers can also check out Very Heaven at Domino Theater starting at 7:30. Friday is packed with concerts and nightlife around the city. The Tet Center hosts their quick and cute scrapbook and card classes from 6 to 8:45 p.m., while Dream, the greatest show, takes over at the Kingston Grand Theater at 7 p.m. Live music includes Gershwin, Porter & Me, featuring Angela, Verbrugg, and Ray Gallen at Hotel Wolf Island, Lucas Oak at the Loaf & Ale Pub, and Celtic Kitchen Party at the Turnanog later in the evening. Trivia returns to Wild Wing Kingston while karaoke takes over both the Buckle and Dap Brewing starting at 9 p.m. Heading into Saturday, Earthfest takes over Confederation Park from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., while the Kingston Public Market returns to Springer Market Square, and the Tet Center is also hosting Be the Ark, singing the Collective Action from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Live music highlights Big Mo and the Blues Mission at the RCHA Club, Cut Flowers at Hotel Wolf Island, and the Bryan Adams Tribute Experience at Overtime Sports Bar. If you're looking for something interactive, line dancing returns to the Buckle from 7 to 8 p.m. While the Tet Gallery hosts Collage Club, crafting to create community from 2 to 5 p.m. Live music includes Eric Urin and Megan Ballone returning to the Cove Inn, while the Cantabile Choirs of Kingston and the Kingston Symphony Orchestra perform Sunrise Mass at the Isabel Bader Center. Karaoke also returns to the Merchant Tap House at 9 p.m. That's your weekly events and concerts calendar for June 1st through the 7th. For more information on any of these events, visit the CFRC website and keep it locked right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and listen on the go, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. This is edition 319. And on the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation that I had with an organizer of the Bank Block Tenants Union in Ottawa. This is an exchange with Eric Roberts. I wanted to have a moment to hear directly from a tenant union organizer within the context of an urban environment in Canada where people have been fighting collectively for tenant rights. There's an upswing in tenant union organizing around different cities in Quebec, in Canada, and beyond. And I think this is an important window into the specifics of a fight against a series of evictions in the Bank Block, which is located in downtown Ottawa. And through that, understand the mechanisms and organizing process around tenant unions more generally. This is a case study or an example that we hear about, but I think it brings up some larger questions and reflections about tenant union organizing today. So here's my conversation with Eric Roberts of the Bank Block Tenant Union in Ottawa on this edition of Free City Radio.
The reality is that in all major population centers in Canada and cities, people are being squeezed. Working people, low-income people, many communities, newly arrived folks, immigrant, refugee communities. And often the media narrative around this kind of paints it as this invisible force that's kind of just happening. You know, things are getting more expensive, rents are going up, and there's no sort of organization or sort of organizational process that's allowing this to happen? Obviously, there is, if we're talking about municipal powers and decision making, or also economic policies on a broader level. And so there's also people who are responding to this, and tenant unions have been really getting organized in the last few years in different communities across cities like Ottawa and Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, Regina, Winnipeg. And Eric, you have been part of a very particular tenant organizing process in Ottawa. Maybe you could just introduce yourself and talk about how some of these larger questions are impacting Ottawa as a city, and then just also just briefly introduce us to the tenant union that you've been part of. Thank you so much.
Yeah, sure. My name is Eric, and I live in the west end of Ottawa, following the displacement of our block, which happened over the course of this fall. A few of us ended up staying in the neighborhood, and a few of us didn't. And prior to that, I lived downtown in Ottawa for at least 20 years. And so I got to see the neighborhood changing quite a bit over that time. And I would say that overall now it's much more difficult for people to afford housing. For working people who are, reliant on basically wages, it's not easy now because the prices of rent have skyrocketed. So that has caused a lot of people to no longer live downtown, but also to change living arrangements. And there's, maybe living with more other people. And then there's a whole lot of forced displacement that has happened. People being evicted basically in order to be able to rent those units out for much more to someone else.
Thanks so much for underlining this process, Eric, and also for sharing that it's been something that affected you directly also. You mentioned a really important point, I think, which is this reality that working people relying on wages can't afford to pay their rent. And so this, I think, is clearly part of the dynamic that's led to the really a plethora of tenant union organizing that's been happening. Maybe if you could just talk a bit about that connection between this very sort of baseline fact, which I think still has largely not been acknowledged fully by mainstream political discourse of working people not being able to afford basic things like rent.
One thing I can say about that is that on our block, when it came to the point that we were given notice that that there was a development plan for the block that included demolition and eviction, it wasn't difficult to connect with people over the idea that this would be like a very difficult situation for all of us. Like pretty much everybody on the block was would see it as kind of a crisis for us. And so in order for us to start talking to each other and to begin to act collectively, in some ways it was natural because like the conditions and the potential for our conditions to change the change would be so drastic from what we had on that block, that it was, like the conversations, even the very initial conversations when we didn't know each other too well were, it was not difficult. So that's something I always remember. And I know there's a lot of buildings that are also under attack where there has been a lot more turnover over the years and decades. But on our block, a lot of people had lived there for decades. People had been there 40 years, 30, 40 years, several individuals. So that meant that, well, eviction for a household like that is like you're being pushed out into a completely different world, you know, compared to when you first occupied that space.
Thanks for sharing that, Eric. And I think the point that you mentioned about the organizing process being kind of smooth, or like the fact that people were facing something in common, you know, is something to underline. And thanks for mentioning that, because that probably relates to many communities in cities across Quebec and Canada, where there's that common experience of people not being able to afford their rents. So I think that that brings us to the point of why tenant union organizing, right? Because I think some people could sort of, I don't know how to put it exactly, but maybe be drawn towards telling individual stories about people being evicted, right? Often there's, like, for example, CBC profiles about, you know, this particular family that's facing an eviction that's quite clearly unjust. That's quite different from a sort of narrative that thinks about collective power as tenants. So can you talk a bit about that and why that understanding of collectivity as tenants is important?
I would say it's important because it acknowledges that the problem is systemic, and that the, I think you said earlier, this system was not created by accident, and the conditions that tenants face are, they are part of a system that is very profitable for, you know, a certain class of people in our cities, and I think it's a mistake to look at the conditions that tenants face as something that is because of politicians not knowing how to organize a city. I think they do know how to organize a city, and it's just the question is more that it's organized in favor of people who are not tenants, people who are owning property, people who are profiting from property on the backs of tenants.
Thanks for underlining that really important point. It might seem obvious, but still, I think there's a sort of understanding that the sort of political class within cities is trying to fix the situation of the housing crisis. And I think that's quite different narrative from the points that you just underlined. Can you talk about Bank Bloc Tenants Union and sort of, you know, maybe not all the details, but just sort of that group as a political organizing space, and why that was important for people on your particular block in Ottawa that were facing eviction?
Yeah, sure. I think the desire for most of the people who lived on the block was to keep their homes, and that is when I think that, like, what we found as tenants who wanted to not be mass evicted in Ottawa, like, we did not have support of politicians, because the, you know, when we tried to access those channels, the idea is that, well, you guys have done so well, so maybe you deserve a buyout, you know, and that for a lot of us was not acceptable, because it wasn't going to be protecting us as tenants for a longer term, like a long period of time. We looked at a buyout as being something that could help over a period of maybe, you know, a few months or maybe a couple of years at the most. And I think that one of the strengths of the union over the course of about 2 to 3 years that we were organizing is that there was a lot of agreement on the idea of pushing for us to be able to remain in our homes. And that sometimes the focus sometimes had to be kind of attacking the problems with the development plan. But underlying all of that, we felt like, you know, even if the plan had been better, there still wasn't really a justification for us to be displaced from our homes.
And so for people who are hearing this, to just sort of understand, the organizing of tenants in your particular community was around having assemblies. There, I'm sure, were some actions that took place, some community events. And I'm asking this just to sort of, for people who are hearing this and, you know, have thought about this issue, but might not have had that type of organizing experience. I know that in your particular case, Eric, with Bank Block Tenants Union, the evictions have been taking place, but still there are also other experiences in different communities in Canada where people have resisted evictions. And I'm sure that you held off a number of evictions for some time. So yeah, maybe just sort of a bit of the nuts and bolts of like how you organized in the tenant union.
Yeah, sure. Well, yeah, first of all, the organizing had some impact, I would say, for sure, on our situation. We were able to stay for about an extra 2 years beyond when they initially wanted us out. And so over the course of that time, there was a lot of different tactics that we got into. There were, I guess the main theme of our work was trying to communicate with our landlords directly. And so we tried to do that in various ways, kind of escalating over the time period, because we never really, the landlords never really became forthcoming in wanting to talk to us directly as a group. And so we were initially, showing up as a group at their office, tried that a couple times. And then eventually we were in their own neighborhoods where a couple of the key investors lived. And, we ended up there quite a bit. Over the final year, we were in their neighborhoods. That we found that was it seemed to be the tactic that seemed most promising to us, and it was the one where we felt like at least we could not be ignored for those moments that we were there, and. So that happened a lot. We did a lot of organizing around different connections that some of the investors have in the community. And, you know, that brought us to, like, the campuses and a lot of postering and flyering around the neighborhoods and stuff. And, we also did a ton of door knocking in the neighborhood, just to let people know what was going on with us. And and also to try to figure out, you know, the context for what we were experiencing, asking people about what they were experiencing in their own buildings. And we ended up making like quite a few neighborhood connections out of that work. And I would say like that work was kind of like the seeds of like a neighborhood union that does now exist in Centertown, which is the neighborhood that our block is on. And so, yeah, Centertown Tenant Power is the union that exists in the neighborhood now.
Well, great to hear a little bit about some of the thinking and the tactics that have been important to your process. I think it's always interesting to sort of talk openly about, you know, some of the sort of hubs, sort of like organizational process hub points that people work through as in the community. Sometimes these things are seem out of reach, right? I've talked to so many people here in Montreal who maybe are facing challenges around evictions, you know, community media workers, folks I've worked with at restaurants, artists, you know, many other contexts who maybe just aren't aware that there is a possibility to assert some sort of political power as tenants. So thanks for going over those points. Maybe I'll just ask you a little bit about your thoughts on this rise of tenant unions that has been taking place across Canada. I think it's really interesting, and it's sort of under the radar for quite a few people. So what do you think about that sort of political phenomenon, if you want to call it that?
I guess, like for me, I only became aware of the proliferation of tenant union work when we had to start doing our own work on our block. And we did, early on, we did reach out to a few unions in other cities that had been on the go already for a few years so that we could get a few tips and pointers and stuff. And it seems to me that it is a reflection of like how fast conditions are changing for tenants. So, you know, when I was younger, if I had to move, like, it was no big deal. You know, you could always find another home for, you know, and you could expect to pay basically the same. Like, if it was a year or two or 3 years later, you would just land on your feet. And and like, that just isn't the case now. You have to, as a tenant, either expect to keep paying like huge jumps in rent if you're gonna like leave a place voluntarily, and you know, if you are thinking of staying in your city where you live, you're just hoping that your building doesn't get targeted. And like, that just wasn't on the radar for, like, living in downtown Ottawa, at least like 20 years ago, it just wasn't like that at all. I can say that it's a huge change, and I think it's also like very difficult to even when you are in a place like the proportion of people's income that goes to rent now is quite a bit higher. So it's like, when people are trying to figure out how to organize their lives, I think it does make sense for all of those reasons that like, housing is going to be prioritized in a way that it wasn't before. And because tenants are, like, on an individual basis, tenants are basically at the mercy of their landlords. And so the union is really the only way to change that. Like, there's really no other way to try to get a foothold as a tenant. So I think that's why it's happening.
Thanks for sharing that, Eric. Just on the last point that I sort of emerges out of some of the discussion that we've been having today, and thanks for that, is to just sort of think about the ways that financialization of housing has played such a critical role in the dynamics that you're describing. And I think that still, just on a very definition-based level of the sort of folding in of relatively publicly accessible rental units into these financialization processes where investment firms are sort of eating up portfolios that are put together based on real estate investments and companies that go in and sort of literally occupy tenant buildings, buy up these tenant buildings. I'm sure it's related to some of what you experienced directly, this financialization reality.
Yeah. The portfolios are getting giant, and I would say the number of units in any major city that are controlled by someone who has a giant portfolio is much larger now. So, you know, they're the ones setting prices, and that's I think the major reason for the squeeze on tenants. The idea that these are giant portfolios, I think, is very important because it allows these entities to absorb the cost of vacancy in a way that smaller entities feel pressure to keep units occupied, which has some type of stabilizing effect on rent. Whereas when you can just sit on property and maybe not even develop it, just have an empty lot, and that land value is rising no matter whether you do anything with it or not. And then if you do build some residential units on that block, you are not sweating it if your rent is above what most people can afford. And if you end up with vacancy, that's not a big concern for you.
Thanks for going over that point, Eric. And just to underline, one of the things that you said was these sort of investment actors playing a direct role in deciding the sort of frameworks of tenant reality in terms of what people pay for rent and sort of how that sort of folds out into huge areas of all cities in Canada, and that role of sort of the financialization process as eating accessible housing, rental housing, relatively accessible rental housing. So it's meaningful to hear both your reflections and a description a bit about your organizing process. Thanks so much, Eric, for taking the time to speak to us today. And just say again the name of the new tenant union formation that you're part of. Thank you.
Yes, it's Centertown Tenant Power. And I'll say also that, so that's the neighborhood we're all living in on Bank Block. Adjacent to that neighborhood, there are two other new tenant unions in the city. There is Tosh, Tenants of Sandy Hill, and also the Lower Town Tenant Union. So those are all downtown Ottawa.
That was a conversation with Eric Roberts, who is a community organizer involved in the Bank Block Tenant Union in Ottawa. Thanks so much for being on the program this week. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and you can find us weekly broadcasting on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CGLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Tuesdays at 4 p.m., and on CHMA
106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We're also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.